armed convoys and bombardments, but no one could get there before that night. That night it was the turn of the victor of the Battle of the Java Sea, Vice Admiral Takagi Takeo, to blast the Lunga airfield with the flagship of the 5th Cruiser Division, heavy cruiser Myoko, and the Maya, sister to the luxurious Chokai, and an escort of light cruiser Isuzu and destroyers of Admiral Tanaka's 2nd destroyer flotilla. The Maya tossed up 450 more of those Type 3 incendiaries and Type 91 armor-piercing shells, while the flagship Myoko chipped in with 462 8-inch shells. Two of the escorting destroyers added 253 rounds of 5-inch ammunition. For the Marines, this was getting ridiculous. At dawn on October 16th, the Cactus Air Force had only 9 Wildcats, 11 Dauntlesses, and 7 Aero Cobras operational. "I don't think we have a goddamn Navy," snarled General Geiger to the Saratoga's Lieutenant Commander Simpler. Geiger spoke for a great many within the Lunga perimeter, but Simpler was going to defend his service. "We have one, General, and I think I can find it." Simpler went out in the last flyable Saratoga Wildcat and found the Hornet, who nevertheless would not let him land. Simpler headed back and found the Hornet's aircraft joining Marine and Army pilots in some of their 7 attacks on the Japanese landing zones and supply drops near Kokumbona. The Cactus Air Force needed the help because the strain was showing. On one mission involving 4 P-400 Aero Cobras, one had a bomb but only one 30-caliber machine gun functioning, the second had a bomb but no functioning guns, the third and fourth had most of their guns functional but no bombs. The 67th Fighter Squadron's history does not describe it in glowing terms. The day was a weary succession of taking off, bombing and strafing, landing to refuel and rearm, and taking off again. The helping hand of the Hornet was not only at Guadalcanal, but at Recada Bay, where they pounded the annoying R-Area Air Force's staging area. They claimed to have destroyed everything of military value, including 8 roofs, 5 biplanes, 3 twin-float seaplanes, and all shore installations. Multiple airstrikes found no ships off Guadalcanal, though. "It is regretted that more suitable targets were not available," commented Commander Walter F. Rohde of the Hornet. Even more regrettably, the Japanese found the Hornet. Lieutenant Hinata Yoshihiko of the Toko Air Group radioed that he had found the carrier 60 miles southeast of Guadalcanal on a course of 300 degrees true northwest. In return, Hinata's Type 97 flying boat was discovered by Lieutenant J.G. Frank Christofferson of Bombing 8, flying an SBD on inner air patrol looking for submarines. Christofferson made 5 attacks that emptied his guns, only to take a 20-millimeter hit from Hinata's tail gun. Christofferson was forced to ditch near the destroyer Morris, who picked up him and his gunner unharmed. Hornet fighter pilots Lieutenant Tom Johnson and Ensign Phil Souza went hunting for the crafty Kawanishi, but struggled finding it in the clouds. Then Souza saw the biggest airplane I had ever seen, Hinata's very large Type 97 flying boat, which responded to attack with tracers the size of red ping-pong balls. Hinata was able to evade Johnson and Souza by ducking into a cloud, but when he came out, he found Souza with Lieutenant J.G. Robert H. Hennings waiting for him. They caught the giant flying boat in a vicious crossfire. The Mavis exploded, as Mavises so often did. Its engines, with the propellers still spinning, fell away, and the burning aircraft disintegrated some 18 miles from the Hornet. Yet Lieutenant Hitaka had done his job. By now Admiral Nagumo's Kido Butai was heading north to refuel, but there was still Admiral Kusaka's base air force. In response to his contact report, multiple airstrikes were launched, including one of 9 Type 99 carrier bombers under Reserve Lieutenant Kitamura Norimasa of the 31st Air Group, escorted by 12 Zeros of the 6th Air Group, under Lieutenant J.G. Kawamata Katsutoshi, that took off at 3 p.m. from Buin, hunting for the Hornet. Right on cue at 4:05 p.m., Coast Watcher Donald Kennedy warned of hearing a fair number of aircraft passing over New Georgia, heading southeast. Also right on cue at 5 p.m., 11 Wildcats of Marine Fighting 121, under First Lieutenant Edwin C. Fry, scrambled. The Japanese pilots prowled the Coral Sea south of Guadalcanal, but did not find a carrier. Lieutenant Kitamura decided to head back after a detour over Lunga. There at 5:30, Kitamura found the McFarland. At 1:20 p.m., the old destroyer had anchored about 300 yards off Lunga and began unloading oil drums and torpedoes. She also began pumping aviation fuel into oil drums on a barge tethered to her starboard side. For the trip out, she began taking on board the ground crews from Marine Air Group 23 and the last of the pilots from the Saratoga's Fighting Five. The McFarland had offloaded about half her cargo, largely because, aside from one false alarm, she had no interference, since Space Air Force was too busy looking for the Hornet to bother them. Until now. On the advice of his old friend, Lieutenant Commander Simpler, the McFarland skipper, Lieutenant Commander John C. Elderman, cut loose the barge and got underway. The Vals, each armed with two 132-pound bombs, all dove on the old destroyer as Lieutenant Fry's fighters apparently missed them completely. The first bomb hit the McFarland amidships on the port side, but the rest of the bombs missed astern, except for the last bomb. This landed on the McFarland stern, where it detonated the depth charges, blowing off the stern and sending white-hot fragments into the desperately needed 20,000 gallons of aviation fuel on the barge, which went up in flames. The McFarland lashed out with her 20-millimeter anti-aircraft guns, which sent the Val of Reserve Ensign Kawaga Atushi up in flames and down into the water. The remaining Vals strafed Kukum before heading home. The Japanese may have evaded Lieutenant Fry's defending Wildcats, but they could not evade Lieutenant Colonel Joe Bauer, who had just arrived from Espiritu Santo with 19 Marine Fighting 212 Wildcats, 7 Dauntlesses, and 4 R-4Ds bringing in aviation fuel and taking out wounded and crews set to be pulled out, including the Saratoga's Fighting 5. With his fuel tanks almost dry, Bauer was waiting until his charges had landed when he saw the blazing McFarland and a line of Vals heading away at an altitude of about 200 feet. Flying on empty did not bother Bauer. In full view of those at Lunga, he roared after the Vals at full speed and started gobbling them up like Pac-Man, shooting down Warrant Officer Iwami Kenzo, Petty Officer 3rd Class Tokuoka Masahiro, and Petty Officer 3rd Class Ozeki Mitsuo, one by one by one. Bauer later grumbled that if he had the gas, he would have shot down all 8 of them. The determination of Joe Bauer helped turn this small mission into a costly one for Base Air Force. Lieutenant Kitamura's Vals landed at Buin at 8:30 p.m., having already lost 4 Type 99s, a fifth broke up on the runway. Lieutenant Kawamata's escorting Zeros got tangled up with 4 B-17s who had guided Bauer's flight into Guadalcanal and accomplished nothing. Steering by engine, Lieutenant Commander Alderman guided the McFarland toward Tulagi, but she lost power and had to be towed in by YP-239 around midnight. From her crew and passengers, there were 9 killed, 28 wounded, and 18 missing. It was a gruesome end to the day, but October 16th ended far better than the previous 3 nights had. Before the attack, the McFarland had landed 20,000 gallons of precious aviation fuel. Moreover, once Joe Bauer landed, he gave a rousing speech that provided a desperately needed morale boost. Despite the body blows of the past 3 days, thanks to the toughness of the pilots, the ground crews, the mechanics, and the Seabees, the Cactus Air Force was still alive, bloodied to be sure, but unbroken. Yet the Japanese smelled that blood in the water, and now on land. They were coming. The bombardment by the Kongo and Haruna may have caused ground tremors on Guadalcanal, but it sent aftershocks all the way to Washington. On October 16th, a reporter asked Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, "Do you think we can hold Guadalcanal?" Knox answered, "I certainly hope so and expect so. I will not make any predictions, but every man will give a good account of himself. What I am trying to say is that there is a good stiff fight going on. Everybody hopes we can hold on." It was not an answer that could or would buoy the spirits. Already, the Marines were tired of weak-kneed reports by some official about our precarious situation. Knox was a politician, but he had been an Army officer. He should have known better. But at least he was no longer an officer leading men into battle, nor had he been for decades. Others did not have that excuse. By General Vandegrift's estimate, the Japanese now had some 15,000 troops on Guadalcanal, enough to make a land attack on the Lunga perimeter. That same day, he sent a message to Admirals Nimitz, Garmley, and Turner. "Our force exceeds that number, but more than half of it is in no condition to undertake a protracted land campaign due to incessant hostile operations. The situation demands two urgent and immediate steps. A. Take and maintain control of sea areas adjacent to Cactus to prevent further enemy landings and enemy bombardment such as this force has taken for the last 3 nights. B. Reinforcement of ground forces by at least one division in order that extensive operations may be initiated to destroy hostile force now on Cactus. Admiral Gormley quickly responded with a message to Admirals Nimitz and King and all the ships under his command. Urgently need this area, one additional Army Infantry Division. Present force is insufficient to garrison present bases, and therefore obviously inadequate to support offensive operations. Have neither on hand nor in sight sufficient forces to render Cactus secure against present infiltration tactics. In other words, even in this crisis, Admiral Gormley was still unwilling to take forces from the rear bases in order to support the Marines on Guadalcanal. It went back to his original belief that the Guadalcanal offensive would fail, and those rear bases would then need to be defended. What was it Admiral King had said about making the best of what you have? And if Admiral Gormley was not willing to use all the forces already under his command, how would Admiral King convince Generals Marshall and Arnold, always stingy with reinforcements for the Pacific, to give him more? But that was not all. Despite the emergency on Guadalcanal, Admiral Gormley yanked the Hornet away from her supporting position and sent her to the southeast, out of range of the Japanese, where she would hopefully meet the Enterprise soon. After receiving reports from Canberra that a Japanese carrier force was west of the Santa Cruz Islands, at 4 p.m. on October 16th, Admiral Gormley sent another dispatch to Admirals Nimitz and King. This appears to be all-out enemy effort against Cactus, possibly other positions also. My forces totally inadequate to meet situation. Urgently request all available reinforcements possible. For Admiral Nimitz, it was the last straw. Chapter 10. The Lion Comes. An army of sheep led by a lion is more to be feared than an army of lions led by a sheep. This quote, or some variant thereof, is usually attributed to Alexander the Great. It is a sound piece of wisdom. And when a consolidated PB-2Y Coronado flying boat set down in Noumea at 2 p.m. on October 18th, there was little doubt that the VIP aboard was a lion. Vice Admiral William F. Halsey had arrived. Halsey was in Noumea to take over the Enterprise task force, but the Enterprise was not yet ready for him, so he was touring his area of operations, familiarizing himself with it, visiting the bases he would use, and talking to the people with whom he would be dealing. As the propellers stopped spinning, a boat carrying Admiral Gormley's flag lieutenant came alongside to carry Halsey to the flagship Argonne to speak with his new superior. Halsey stepped aboard. The lieutenant saluted him and gave him an envelope. Inside that envelope was another envelope marked Secret. Halsey opened the envelope. Syncpack. You will take command of the South Pacific area and South Pacific forces immediately. Admiral Halsey had to read it twice. Jesus Christ and General Jackson, this is the hottest potato they ever handed me. The new commander of the South Pacific forces was still digesting his new assignment when he stepped aboard the Argonne to meet with the old commander of the South Pacific forces, Vice Admiral Robert Gormley, who had been informed of his removal the previous day. Gormley greeted Admiral Halsey warmly. The two had been friends since their Naval Academy days, but the meeting felt awkward. "This is a tough job they've given you, Bill," Admiral Gormley said. "I damn well know it," Halsey replied. They both went to Gormley's cabin, where Halsey was briefed on the situation in and around Guadalcanal. Questions about Gormley's fitness for command had been building since planning began for the Guadalcanal campaign. He did not attend planning meetings in Coro, sending a representative instead, which displayed a curious lack of interest in an operation he had been ordered to command in person in the operating area by Admiral King. Admiral Nimitz's late September visit was in part to check on Gormley. Nimitz returned to Pearl Harbor, hoping for the best, but he was deeply concerned about Gormley's mindset. He later told his wife, "Gormley was too immersed in detail and not sufficiently bold and aggressive at the right times." To use an analogy to today's world, where sports coaches are known for playing to win versus playing not to lose, Admiral Gormley played as if he had already lost. During a September 28th meeting with Admiral Nimitz, Garmley had reacted to two urgent messages from Guadalcanal with the exclamation, "My God, what are we going to do about this?" Nimitz was quite unsettled by the defeatism contained in that statement. Garmley was not resourceful. Quite the opposite, he was loath to use the resources he had because they would be needed when the Guadalcanal offensive failed. Moreover, Garmley had isolated himself. Local French officials had denied him the use of a headquarters ashore, so he confined himself to the Argonne, where, in the sweltering cabins with no air conditioning, he worked very hard. But cabin fever seems to have set in and affected both his judgment and his mood. The isolation had practical drawbacks as well. Garmley would write, "I did not know from actual contact the ability of the officers, nor the material condition of the ships, nor their readiness for battle, nor did I know their degree of training for warfare such as was soon to develop in this area. Improvement was acquired while carrying out combat missions." Sun Tzu wrote, "It is said that if you know your enemies and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles." And here Garmley was admitting he did not know himself. Knowing was his job. Indeed, he still had not visited Guadalcanal. The final straw seems to have been his panicked October 15th message, calling his forces totally inadequate to meet a Japanese carrier attack that never materialized. That same night, Admiral Nimitz met with his staff members, who had accompanied him on his South Pacific tour. Some of them noticed his normally warm blue eyes were an icy gray. Admiral Nimitz opened the meeting with a short lecture. Apparently referring to Garmley's message, he stated, "I don't want to hear or see such pessimism. Remember, the enemy is hurting, too." It was apparent, the admiral said, that the Japanese were about to launch a major offensive. He wanted his staff's impressions of the situation, specifically concerning Admiral Garmley. Garmley said Nimitz was an intelligent and dedicated officer, but, he asked, was Garmley tough enough to handle the situation? Could he inspire the men under his command? After some discussion, the staff officers unanimously answered both questions with a resounding no. Admiral Nimitz finished the discussion with, "All right, I'm going to poll you." He pointed to each man in turn and asked, "Is it time for me to relieve Garmley?" Each man responded to the question with the same one-word answer, "Yes." They started talking about potential replacements. Admiral Turner was the natural choice. He was a brilliant strategic thinker who had headed the Navy's War Plans Office before the war. Turner was also familiar with the area and its challenges. However, he was also arrogant and irascible, qualities that had alienated the Marines and especially General Vandegrift. Admiral Halsey's name came up. He was recently off the injured list and ready for action. Halsey was a pilot, known as a fighter, and very popular throughout the Navy, especially with enlisted men. Like Turner, though, Halsey was combative and short-tempered, and they wondered if his combat leadership skills would translate into an effective theater commander. Halsey had once been given an assignment to command the Norfolk Navy Yard. He told the Navy's personnel chief, who at that time was Nimitz, that he didn't feel suited to administering an industrial establishment, which was exactly what the South Pacific Command was. Admiral Nimitz adjourned the meeting and went back to his quarters to ponder the issues. Late that night, he was called to the phone. A small group of staff officers wished to speak with the admiral to express their opinion. Nimitz agreed to give them 5 minutes, and the officers, none of whom had any knowledge of the earlier meeting, were invited in. In his pajamas, Nimitz listened as they got straight to the point. "Admiral Garmley should be replaced," they said, "with Admiral Halsey." Nimitz thanked them for their concern and said he would consider their opinion. After a sleepless night, the next morning, Admiral Nimitz sent a message to Admiral King. "In view of Gormley's latest dispatch and other indications, including some noted during my visit, I have under consideration his relief by Halsey at earliest practicable time. Request your comment." King's response was prompt, succinct, and brutal. "Affirmative." The news of Admiral Halsey's appointment spread like the proverbial wildfire across the South Pacific. The effect was electric, with cheers and celebration among the officers and sailors of the fleet. "We were absolutely elated when we heard the news," said Assistant Gunnery Officer Ed Hooper of the battleship Washington. "It was a shot of adrenaline for the whole command. Things had been getting pretty wishy-washy down there." The Atlanta's Robert Graff took a slightly different angle. During wartime, it's important how the leadership, starting with the Chief of Naval Operations, gets a message across to everybody in every ship, submarine, airplane, and shore station. You need to hear it said that this is an extraordinary moment in your life and in the life of the country, and that you're not going to let it down. Until that day, we had received no such message. If the effect on the fleet was electric, the effect on Guadalcanal was nuclear. Lieutenant Commander Roger Kent, an air information officer there, described the atmosphere upon hearing the news. One minute we were too limp with malaria to crawl out of our foxholes. The next we were running around, whooping like kids. Two Marines embarked on a scientific discussion of the true value of the old man as the new Admiral Halsey. One claimed Halsey was worth two battleships and two carriers. The other insisted Halsey was worth two battleships and three carriers. This largely theoretical disagreement was settled only with increasing volume and ultimately some physical debate. Admiral Halsey went straight to work. By word of mouth, and even by posted signs, he made everyone aware of his wartime credo, kill Japs, kill Japs, kill more Japs. He almost immediately ended the quixotic quest to build an airbase at Andaini, thereby releasing the forces involved to Guadalcanal. He told Pearl Harbor he would need his best staffers sent down to serve at his headquarters. Admiral Gormley's old staffers had absorbed his defeatism, which Halsey did not want on his staff. Halsey officially moved the fleet base from distant Auckland to more convenient Noumea. He demanded 1 million square feet of covered storage space for supplies. Just in case the Free French were as obdurate as they had been with Admiral Gormley, he sent his intelligence officer to meet with the Free French governor about getting a headquarters set up ashore. When the governor demurred and kept demurring for a month, Halsey himself came ashore with a contingent of Marines and seized the local headquarters of the High Commissioner for Free France in the Pacific for his own, as well as the former residence of the Japanese consul. At his new headquarters, Halsey installed a plaque that said it all about his management philosophy. Complete with black tie, you do look terrific, but take it off here. This is still South Pacific. Halsey was informal. His men would no longer wear ties in the steamy Solomons. His people would wear informal khakis. He worked hard to eliminate distinctions and thus rivalries between the services. People would not be of the Navy or the Army anymore, just warriors of the South Pacific fighting forces. He would pull in Army technicians to service the fleet and bases, and he wanted their cooperation publicized. I would like to see it widely advertised that the Army is helping us here. I have never seen anything like the spirit here in this neck of woods. It is a real United States service. Since the centerpiece of the South Pacific was Guadalcanal, Admiral Halsey wanted to know everything about the island and its environs. Unfortunately, I began my new job under the crippling handicap of never having seen Guadalcanal, the keystone of the area I was defending. My information about it was not even second-hand, since Bob Gormley and his chief of staff, Rear Admiral Daniel J. Callaghan, had never had an opportunity to see it either. Halsey did the next best thing. He asked the men in command in and around Guadalcanal to fly to Noumea and brief him. So, on the night of October 20th, Admiral Halsey met with General Vandegrift, Army General Alexander M. Patch, Major General Millard F. Harmon, the senior Army officer in the South Pacific, Lieutenant General Thomas Holcomb, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, who was in Noumea on an inspection tour, Major General C. Barney Vogel, who had just arrived as commander of the 1st Marine Amphibious Corps, Admiral Turner and Gormley's other subordinate commanders, and Halsey's staff, such as it was. Generals Vandegrift and Harmon told their stories to Admiral Halsey. Vandegrift said his troops were practically worn out, with not nearly enough sleep or food, but more than enough combat for the past 2 months. He said his troops needed material support and eventual relief, emphasizing that General Patch's AmeriCal Division be sent in, as well as the remainder of the 2nd Marine Division. It was necessarily a very, very long briefing. When they finished, Halsey cut to the chase. Are we going to evacuate or hold? Vandegrift replied, I can hold, but I've got to get more active support than I've been getting. It was an answer that irked Admiral Turner. He protested that their already small logistical capacity was getting smaller every day. On Guadalcanal there was no base, Iron Bottom Sound had no space to maneuver, there were not enough warships to protect the supply convoys who had to run the gauntlet of Japanese submarines to get to Guadalcanal. General Vandegrift looked at Halsey. The new South Pacific commander understood that what Admiral Turner said was completely true, and also completely irrelevant. Halsey was decisive. He nodded. All right, go on back. I'll promise you everything I've got. Getting Vandegrift everything Halsey got came with its own dangers, about one of which Halsey was about to learn. Recall Destroyer O'Brien was torpedoed with the North Carolina in the same attack that sank the Wasp on September 15th in Torpedo Junction. Despite the fact that a single torpedo hit is usually enough to sink a destroyer, the damage to the O'Brien seemed to create more of a shark mouth on her bow than a serious danger. Skipper Commander Thomas Burroughs had her stop in Espiritu Santo and Noumea for emergency repairs to make the trip back to San Francisco. She left Noumea on October 10th, with the destroyer Lang and the fleet oiler Cimarron reaching Suva on October 13th, where they repaired patches that had started leaking in the forward engine room. That was a bad sign. The signs did not improve after they left on the afternoon of October 16th. The leaks returned, slowly but surely getting worse. By the morning of October 18th, cracks had formed in the forward engine room patch, the shell, and most worrisome, the keel. Commander Burroughs headed the O'Brien to the nearest port, Pongo Pongo, jettisoning as much topside weight as he could. The ship's creaking and groaning gave way to the noise of a pistol shot as a shell plate cracked open at 3:37 the next morning. Forget the nearest port. The O'Brien headed for the nearest land, only 40 miles away. It might as well have been 4,000 miles. At around 6 a.m. on October 19th, the bottom fell out. Literally. The O'Brien's keel snapped, and the destroyer's bottom cracked wide open. The O'Brien was now held together only by her shell and her main deck, and within 30 minutes the main deck started splitting. The bow and stern sections started grinding and working separately. What had happened was the explosion of the torpedo had caused a severe flexural vibration of the ship girder, the keel, weakening both it and its connecting support members. The emergency repairs had not been enough to shore up the structural damage. As a result, the O'Brien had progressively cracked up and was now disintegrating. The end was coming fast. The crew was completely evacuated by 7:01 a.m., all picked up by the Lang and the Cimarron. Only 45 minutes later, the O'Brien broke almost completely in half and folded like a jackknife. The stern sank at 7:57 a.m., the bow quickly following. But Admiral Halsey's introduction to Torpedo Junction was not yet complete. While he was meeting everyone on October 20th, Rear Admiral Willis Augustus Lee was having his task force, centered on the new battleship Washington, support a supply run to Guadalcanal. With the battleship was the heavy cruiser San Francisco, once again the flagship of Rear Admiral Scott, and Chester, now the flagship of Rear Admiral Wright, light cruiser Helena, light anti-aircraft cruiser Atlanta, and destroyers Aaron Ward, Walk, Benham, Laffey, Buchanan, Lansdowne, McCalla, Fletcher, and Lardner. At 7:30 that night, Admiral Scott led the San Francisco, Helena, Chester, Laffey, McCalla, Walk, and Buchanan to split off and have her Espiritu Santo to refuel. Scott had the cruisers form a column, zigzagging at 19 knots as an anti-submarine measure. That failed. At 9:20 p.m. off San Cristobal, the Chester, last in the cruiser column, took one torpedo in the forward engine room. A second crossed in front of the bow. Both were courtesy of the Japanese submarine I-176 and its skipper, Lieutenant Commander Tanabe Yahachi, who, as skipper of the I-168, had finished off the Yorktown after Midway. Not quite as devastating this time, but bad enough. The Chester lost power and drifted to a stop with a 500-square-foot gash. The cruiser's forward engine room and number 3 fire room were flooded, and two of her engines were disabled. Both of her SOC float planes had to be jettisoned. The Laffey and McCalla were detailed to assist the Chester, while the remainder of Admiral Scott's ships, now joined by the Fletcher, continued on. Power was restored in short order, and she was able to limp at 8 knots to Espiritu Santo. The Chester would be out of action for almost a year. Tanabe and the I-176 escaped. Again. Nevertheless, the most serious issue in the South Pacific Command continued to be air power. As of October 18th, the 1st Marine Air Wing had only 74 aircraft available, 32 Wildcats, 27 Dauntlesses, a measly 4 Avengers, and 11 Aero Cobras. By comparison, Base Air Force had 55 Zeros, 49 Bettys, 13 Vals, and 1 land reconnaissance plane, and 5 flying boats. To support Guadalcanal, all the nearby bases had been stripped to the point where they barely had enough to defend themselves. Espiritu Santo, for example, had only 16 fighters left to protect it. The only replacements en route to Guadalcanal were 8 Dauntlesses and 2 Avengers being shipped on the carrier Enterprise, but no one knew when they would arrive. General Geiger reported a critical shortage of fighters to Fleet Air West Coast at San Diego, who were loading the escort carrier Altamaha for shipment to the South Pacific. When she left port, she would be carrying, among other things, 50 Wildcats. But she would not leave until November 3rd, and would take 3 weeks to get there. So in terms of air power, Admiral Halsey would be on his own until mid-November. Admiral Nimitz had found his lion, but could this lion become the king of the Solomon's jungle? While Allied command in the South Pacific was changing and reorganizing itself, a single-file column of some 5,500 troops of the 2nd Sendai Division, led by Lieutenant General Maruyama Masao, was worming its way through the jungle closer to the weak link in the Marine lines defending Henderson Field. General Hyakutake's plan to finally take Henderson Field was overly complicated, as Japanese plans tended to be. This time it was the result of compromise. Colonel Matsumoto Hiroshi, the operations officer for the Sendai Division, wanted to attack near the coast. The politically powerful Lieutenant Colonel Tsuji Masanobu of the 17th Army, who also represented Imperial General Headquarters, wanted to attack from heights several miles inland to the south of Henderson Field. Hyakutake figured, why not attack both? And so began this latest Imperial Japanese Army attack on the Henderson Field perimeter. The Sendai Division's 4th Infantry Regiment, the Aoba Detachment, supported by tanks and artillery, would attack Marine positions along the Matanako River near the coast to the west, complete with a flanking move. Somehow this effort by a unit that was already pretty badly chewed up by early October actions, also along the Matanako River, was supposed to be both a diversion from the real attack and a real attack. Meanwhile, 2 more regiments of the Sendai, the 16th and 29th, plus the 230th Regiment of the 38th Nagoya Division, would have worked their way around the Henderson Field perimeter to perform the real attack, a 2-pronged assault, from the south, where the Marines would least expect it, having covered that sector with only 2 battalions of the 7th Marine Regiment. Imperial General Headquarters set the night of October 21st for the attack. This plan required close coordination between units, which could be problematic on an island that's mainly primordial jungle. General Hyakutake had anticipated this issue and sent engineers to cut a path through the jungle for General Maruyama's troops before they stepped off on October 16th. It became known as the Maruyama Road, no more than 2 feet wide. The troops hacked their way through dense foliage, crossing hills, ridges, streams, and rivers, often in monsoon-like rains that turned the Maruyama Road into a quagmire, making every step a major physical effort and always in stifling humidity. Not surprisingly, the march took longer than anticipated, and it went downhill from there. On October 20th, General Maruyama radioed 17th Army Headquarters that the attack would have to be delayed by 1 day to October 22nd. In notifying his troops, General Hyakutake announced, "The time of the decisive battle between Japan and the United States has come." When October 22nd came, however, Maruyama radioed again, delaying the time of the decisive battle between Japan and the United States to October 23rd. North of the Solomons, the ships of the Imperial Japanese Navy waited impatiently. Collectively called the Support Force under Admiral Kondo, although Admiral Yamamoto himself exercised direct control from the Yamato, sitting comfortably in truck, they were arrayed in 3 major groups forming a triangle. To the west was the so-called Advance Force, with the carriers Junyo and Hiyo under Rear Admiral Kakuta Kakuji, the 3rd Battleship Division with Kongo and Haruna under Vice Admiral Kurita Takeo, heavy cruisers Miyoko and Maya under Vice Admiral Tagaki, 2 more heavy cruisers, flagship Atago and her sister life partner Takao, under the direct command of Kondo, and Admiral Tanaka's 2nd Destroyer Flotilla with flagship light cruiser Isuzu and 12 destroyers. About 100 miles east of the advance force was the main body, consisting of the reconstituted Japanese carrier striking force Kido Butai, with Admiral Nagumo leading fleet carriers Shokaku and Zuikaku, Now, with new light carrier Zuiho and a minimal escort of heavy cruiser Kumano and 8 destroyers, the carrier's escort was so small because most of it was about 100 miles to the south. Using an organizational breakdown similar to that used at Eastern Solomons, this group under Rear Admiral Abe Hiroaki was, again, the so-called Vanguard Force. It featured the 11th Battleship Division, with the Hiei and Kirishima under Abe's direct command, one member of the 7th Cruiser Division, Suzuya, under Rear Admiral Nishimura Shoji, the traditional escorts of Kido Butai of the 8th Cruiser Division, the heavy cruiser seaplane carriers Tone and Chikuma, under Rear Admiral Hara Chuichi, and the 10th Destroyer Flotilla under Rear Admiral Kimura Susumu, with flagship light cruiser Nagara and 7 destroyers. These were a lot of ships to keep at sea at the same time. The 17th Army had been told its naval support could remain at sea for only 2 weeks or so because of fuel issues. Whether the 17th actually appreciated it is unclear. Much of the Navy's impatience was rooted in these concerns, which indeed started to manifest themselves. Oilers had to be sent back to truck to siphon fuel from the Yamato and Mutsu to keep the fleet operating. Admiral Kondo's ships had already been forced to withdraw once to refuel. But just before they did, Kondo had Admiral Kakuta's Junyo and Hiyo perform the first carrier raid on Guadalcanal since August. It did not go well. Expecting to find anchored transports, the attacking aircraft, 18 Zeros and 17 Kates armed with bombs, instead found destroyers Aaron Ward and Lardner shelling Japanese supply dumps near Kokumbona at around 7 a.m. 9 Kates from the Hiyo bombed what they identified as a Honolulu-class cruiser. Which destroyer it actually was is unclear. They all missed. 1 Kate was shot down, and a 2nd was damaged and had to land at Buin. Then 8 Kates from the Junyo tried to attack, but were ambushed by 8 fighting 121 Wildcats under Major Davis, part of 25 Wildcats launched before dawn, in response to a warning from Magic of the planned attack. Only 3 of the Kates managed to drop their payloads, and all missed. 6 Kates were shot down, and the remaining 2, badly damaged, had to crash land at Buin. The vengeful escorting Zeros shot down 2 Wildcats, losing one of their own. That was it for Admiral Kondo, and his ships moved off to refuel again. Vice Admiral Kusaka's base air force stepped up operations in advance of the big offensive that was due to start whenever. On October 18th, Coast Watcher Jack Reed, operating near Buka, reported a dozen fighters headed southeast. It was actually 9 Zeros under Lieutenant J.G. Baba Masayoshi of the Konoya Air Group. The report reached Henderson Field at 10:30 a.m. A half hour later, Colonel Joe Bauer called in his pilots for a briefing. But it was more than a briefing. It was a motivational speech, one that would turn tried and true conventional wisdom on its head. Be an aggressor. You're out there to shoot down enemy planes. Have complete faith in your armor and confidence in your ability to shoot down the enemy when you have him in your sights. When you see Zeros, dogfight him. Up until this point, the conventional wisdom, learned from painful, bitter experience, was never, ever dogfight a Zero, because a Zero could and did outperform American fighters such as the F-4F Wildcat or the P-40 Warhawk. The Americans were forced to use the tactic of boom and zoom, take one pass at a Zero and speed away, then try again. But not anymore. Now, for the most part, they were no longer facing the Japanese pilots who attacked Pearl Harbor, sank the Prince of Wales in Repulse, and rampaged through the Indian Ocean. The skill level of Japanese pilots had decreased markedly. Admiral Halsey was bringing in new aggressiveness, and now Colonel Bauer was, too. 32 Marine Wildcats took to the air. While flying to meet the enemy, they overheard a report from Coast Watcher Donald Kennedy on New Georgia of more aircraft heading southeast. Sounds like a fair number. It was the second part of the base Air Force attack. 15 Bettys, led by Lieutenant Nabeta, escorted by 7 Zeros. A full day of air battles using Joe Bauer's new philosophy cost the Japanese 4 Zeros and 3 Bettys at a cost of 2 Wildcats shot down, with both pilots rescued and a 3rd lost due to accident, the pilot killed. Lieutenant Nabeta claimed he had set Henderson Field afire. His bombers had actually missed it entirely, hitting the Pioneer Battalion bivouac area instead, killing 7 and wounding 18. The next day, October 19th, was not nearly as successful for the Cactus Air Force. The first attempted intercept of a Japanese fighter sweep failed, with one Wildcat performing a mysterious and fatal swan dive from 18,000 feet into Iron Bottom Sound. The second, 16 F-4Fs, was ambushed by 9 Zeros of the 6th Air Group under Lieutenant Miyano Zenjiro. The Wildcats dove away from the Zeros but lost 2 of their number, though both pilots were recovered. No Zeros were shot down. Upon the pilots' return, a furious Colonel Bauer tore into them, demanding, "Why didn't you stay and fight?" and threatening to ship them all out. As General Maruyama took longer and longer to hack his way through the jungle, the costs of waiting multiplied. On October 21st, the Hiyo, converted to a carrier from an ocean liner hull, suffered a fire in her starboard generator room. The fire was put out within 90 minutes, but the damage to her engineering spaces limited her speed to 16 knots, too low to keep up with the fleet or even to operate aircraft in the absence of a headwind. Admiral Kakuta transferred his flag to the Junyo. Using only her port engines, the Hiyo, escorted by destroyers Isonami and Inazuma, headed back to Truk for emergency repairs. Of her air group, 3 Zeros, 1 Val, and 5 Kates were transferred to the Junyo to bring her air group up to full strength, while 17 Zeros and 17 Vals were sent to Rabaul, eventually staging at Dibuin to operate with base air force. A final worrying factor for the combined fleet amidst the waiting for the army to attack was the American aircraft carriers. For some time, the Japanese carriers north of the Solomons had been doing that danse macabre with the carrier Hornet, the only operational U.S. carrier in the Pacific south of the Solomons. Much to the angst of Admiral Nagumo and the Japanese, U.S. Navy Catalina flying boats out of Espiritu Santo were very good when it came to finding the Japanese carriers. So when the Japanese headed south to try to attack the Hornet would move south. When the Japanese gave up and headed back north again, the Hornet would head back north too. It only got worse when their own scouts lost track of the Hornet starting on October 16th. Radio intelligence detected messages to her, so they knew she was there, but the Japanese could not find her visually, though they did find the battleship Washington and some cruisers in the vicinity of Rennell Island. Why could they find the battleship and not the carrier? Was the battleship to lure them into a trap? That's what the Japanese would do, use a few of their extremely limited supply of ships as bait. Yamamoto warned his ships at sea to maintain search patrols to the east. Moreover, on October 15th, Japanese radio intelligence determined that a major U.S. task force had just left Pearl Harbor, headed for the South Pacific. They figured correctly, this was the Enterprise Task Force. The clock was ticking. But the 17th Army could not get its act together. October 23rd saw the date of the attack pushed back yet again to October 24th. During that time, the perfidious Lieutenant Colonel Tsuji connived to get the veteran General Kawaguchi, the most experienced senior officer on Guadalcanal, leading the right flank of the attack, removed. Kawaguchi was a loser, and not nearly enough of a war criminal for Tsuji. He was replaced with Colonel Shoji Toshinaro, who let it be known he did not want the job on the eve of battle. But though the attack had been postponed, again, no one had bothered to tell the units conducting the sort of diversionary attack along the coast of the latest delay. They attacked on schedule at around 6 p.m. on October 23rd and were easily repulsed. The 1st Marine Division lost 25 killed and 14 wounded. The Japanese lost some 600 troops and gained no ground whatsoever. The constant delays got under the skin of Admiral Yamamoto, and especially Admiral Nagumo. In the late afternoon of October 24th, the commander of the much-reduced Kido Butai sat in his cabin, pondering the meaning of 2 reports he had received. One was an October 20th news story from United Press, declaring, "A major sea and air battle is expected in the near future in the Solomon Islands area." The other was a breakdown of the American ships spotted by his scouts since his carriers had arrived. The enemy carriers had been missing for a week. As Admiral Nagumo considered this information, or lack thereof, Commander Takada Toshitane of his staff came in and warned, "Sir, radio men report they are suddenly getting great numbers of undecipherable messages, evidently from nearby enemy submarines and aircraft." "Very well," replied the Admiral wearily, who figured the Americans had located his carriers again. "Call Chief of Staff Kusaka quickly." Kusaka quickly confirmed that his ships were still in the process of refueling. "Any reports on enemy carriers?" "No, sir." The catastrophe at Midway had noticeably aged Admiral Nagumo. His hair had grayed, his face was worn and wrinkled. It had affected him in other ways as well. At Midway, he thought aloud, the enemy struck us at a time of his choosing. Now, too, there is no doubt that the enemy pinpoints our position as if on a chessboard, but we are running blind. "Excuse me, sir," the voice was Commander Takada's. "May I suggest sending a message to Yamato asking for instructions?" After a few moments of silence, it was Admiral Kusaka who spoke up. "All right, Takada, take this message. From Kusaka, 1st Air Fleet Chief of Staff, to Vice Admiral Yugaki, Combined Fleet Chief of Staff. May I suggest halting our southward advance until we receive definite word that the Army has captured Guadalcanal airfields? There seems to be a possibility of our being trapped if we continue going like this." Nagumo nodded silently, and the message was sent. It was after midnight when they received the response. "From Ugaki to Kusaka, your striking force will proceed quickly to the enemy direction. The operation orders stand, without change." The response was coldly military, but its firmness only hinted at the rage at Admiral Nagumo in Combined Fleet Headquarters on the Yamato. This was part of a long-simmering feud between Nagumo and Admiral Yamamoto as to the degree of risk with which Kido Butai should operate. For weeks, Yamamoto had indirectly pressed Nagumo to take the carriers south and attack, but did not make it a direct order. Each time, Admiral Kusaka convinced Nagumo that to do so would lead to another Midway. Avoiding another Midway was foremost in Nagumo's mind, and perhaps not just for tactical reasons. Admiral Yamamoto continued to hold Nagumo responsible for the Midway disaster. When the message was passed to Admiral Yamamoto, he flat out refused to consider it. Admiral Yugaki was angry himself, calling the proposal outrageous, arbitrary, and irresponsible and presumptuous because it would leave the southeast, the most likely avenue for enemy attack, uncovered, and would leave Admiral Kondo's battleships with only the Junyo for air cover. The anger on the Yamato was matched by the disappointment and resignation on the Shokaku. Admiral Nagumo snorted in disgust and ordered, "All right, start fueling the carriers." The anger on the Yamato and the apprehension on the Shokaku both contrasted with the eagerness and borderline arrogance on the Junyo, where Admiral Kakuta Kokuji was considering the same information Admiral Nagumo had and was reaching some very different conclusions. He turned to his air officer, Lieutenant Commander Okumiya Masatake. "Well, what do you say, Masatake?" Lieutenant Commander Okumiya said impassively, "Sir, October 27th is America's Navy Day." Admiral Kakuta leapt from his chair with a laugh. "Very good, very good. Let's hustle and prepare a nice Navy Day gift for those cocky Yanks." It was, finally, the night of October 24th, that the great pincer attack on the south side of the Hendersonfield Marine Perimeter took place. Except that Colonel Shoji's pincer got lost in the rain and the jungle and missed the battle entirely. That can happen when you change commanders on the eve of battle. Nevertheless, after midnight, a phone call came in to General Maruyama's headquarters. It was Colonel Matsumoto, his operations officer, acting as a liaison with Colonel Shoji's troops. "The right flank attacked the airfield," Colonel Matsumoto shouted. "The night attack is a success. Banzai," replied General Maruyama. And so, 50 minutes after midnight, on October 25th, 17th Army sent the victory message. 2300, Banzai. A little before 2300, 11 p.m., the right wing captured the airfield. Finally, the long national nightmare was over. With Henderson Field now out of the way, Admiral Yamamoto ordered Admiral Kondo to take the various elements of his fleet and head south to meet the Americans. Already the area around Guadalcanal was crawling with Japanese naval units, mostly from Admiral Mikawa's 8th Fleet. On the way was Rear Admiral Takama Tamotso's so-called No. 2 attack unit, consisting of light cruiser Yura and destroyers Akizuki, Harusame, Murasame, Samidare, and Yudachi. Their role had been to bombard Henderson Field while still in enemy hands, and then drop troops near Coley Point to cut off the Americans' escape route. Early that morning, an Imperial Army Air Force Mitsubishi Ki-46 twin-engine Type 100 command reconnaissance plane, called Dinah by the Allies, from the 76th Independent Air Squadron, appeared over Henderson Field. Told that Henderson Field was in Japanese hands, the mission of Squadron Commander Captain Kurita Hideo and his crew was to report on the progress of General Maruyama's attack. Lazily, the Mitsubishi buzzed low over Henderson Field, looking for the rising sun flag and friendly troops. It received an unfriendly burst from an anti-aircraft gun that sent the Dyna plummeting into the ground next to the runway. Clearly, Henderson Field was not yet entirely friendly. In fact, several hours after Colonel Matsumoto called to report the night attack is a success, he called again. I was mistaken about the success of the right flank. They crossed a large open field and thought it was the airfield. It was a mistake. What exactly prompted Colonel Matsumoto to give the impression Colonel Shoji's right wing had captured Henderson Field remains a mystery. It may have been a lie. It may have been a product of war fever or malarial fever, more likely the latter. But the 17th Army compounded the error by evidently trying to cover it up. They first announced at 2 a.m. there was continued fighting near the airfield, then only at 6:23 a.m. finally admitted that Henderson Field was still in American hands. At 7 a.m., the search dauntlesses out of Henderson found three Japanese destroyers, Akatsuki, Ikazuchi, and Shiratsuyu, forming the number one attack unit, just 35 miles northwest of Cape Esperance and closing in, fast. Later at 8:30 that morning, the number two attack unit was spotted some 100 miles from Cape Esperance. But Henderson was not in a position to do anything about it just yet. The rain had turned the runways into quagmires. Coast watchers had warned of an incoming flight of Zeros. From Rabaul, Base Air Force was sending 28 fighters, divided into 4 hourly flights. Each was to circle the field for 2 hours, then land if they could see the airfield was in Japanese hands. En route were 9 Zeros of the 3rd Air Group, under Lieutenant J.G. Yamaguchi Sadao, back in action after being shot down on October 3rd, and subsequently rescued by Imperial Army troops. Colonel Bauer selected Captain Joe Foss to lead a flight of 6 fighting 121 Wildcats out of the muck that was Fighter 1 at the moment. At about 9:45, the Marine Grummans took off without flaps to avoid the worst of the mud. They had gotten to only about 1,500 feet before 6 Zeros pounced. Foss and his pilots held the Japanese off until about 6,000 feet, where most of the fighting took place. 2 Zeros were shot down at a cost of 1 Wildcat, whose pilot, 2nd Lieutenant Oscar M. Bate, bailed out and walked back to Henderson Field. The remaining 7 Zeros ended up sparring with a second flight of 7 Marine Fighting 121 F-4Fs under Major Davis, with no loss to either side. Meanwhile, the Japanese destroyers Akatsuki, Ikazuchi, and Shiratsuyu of the 6th Destroyer Division, under Commander Yamada Yusuke, had arrived off Lunga and were making merry mischief. The first ships to fall foul of the intruders were the Trevor and Zane, two old former Four Piper destroyers repurposed as minesweepers, at least one of which was misidentified by the Japanese as a light cruiser. They had transported PT boats, ammunition, and aviation gasoline to Tulagi and were transporting a marine surveying team when, at around 10 a.m., they were warned about 3 Japanese cruisers charging into Iron Bottom Sound. Commander Dwight Agnew, skipper of the Trevor, and commanding the group of minesweepers, had no choice but to run for Sea Lark Channel. The chase began. Commander Agnew rang for as much speed as he could get, 29 knots, causing a boiler casing on the Trevor to burn completely through. Even with Trevor melting a boiler, Commander Yamada's ship still had at least a 6-knot advantage in speed. They started shelling the 2 old minesweepers, with the shell splashes feet, not yards, away from the Zane. Commander Agnew ordered evasive maneuvers and had his guns respond, more for morale purposes since they could not reach the destroyers. Because Sea Lark Channel was too close to the intruders, Agnew steered just north of Sea Lark toward the reef-studded Nagala Channel, hoping the destroyers would run aground or at least have their progress impeded. But the Japanese gained on the old minesweepers, and their guns started scoring. The Zane took a hit amidships that knocked out a gun and killed 3. The old Four Pipers were overmatched. They needed help to escape. And they got it, in the form of 4 Marine Fighting 212 Wildcats commanded by 1st Lieutenant Tex Stout. Their strafing distracted the 3 Japanese vessels enough for the minesweepers to escape. Commander Yamada's destroyers looped around and headed west along the coast of Lunga, where they found the tug Seminole and the patrol boat YP-284 unloading cargo. The Yippie skipper, Lieutenant Carl Rasmussen, saw the 3 destroyers and radioed Tulagi, asking if they were friendly. With a reply in the negative, He ordered full speed back to Tulagi, but at 10:50, the boat was cut to pieces by Japanese gunfire. She quickly sank, with the loss of 3 Marine passengers. The Seminole didn't even try to fight back, but instead moved to beach herself to preserve what she could of her cargo of pack howitzers and gasoline. It was no use. As the 5-inch shells set fire to the gasoline and forced the crew to abandon ship, after which the tug sank at 11:20. One life was lost. Commander Yamada was not done yet. The number one attack unit arrived off Lunga and started to bombard American positions with 5-inch shells. This time, however, the 6th Destroyer Division had picked on someone who could fight back, the Marine 3rd Defense Battalion, with those 5-inch coastal defense guns. At 10:53, the Marines scored one hit on the Akatsuki, setting fire to the magazine for the number 3 mount, killing 4 and severely injuring 1. Yamada's destroyers retreated behind a smokescreen. The strafing by Lieutenant Stout's Wildcats had helped drive the destroyers away, and now, low on ammunition, the Wildcats tried to land. But 8 zeros of Lieutenant J.G. Futagami Tokitane got there first. As the first section of 3 started strafing the airfield, Marine First Lieutenant Jack Conger swung behind them. He set one afire and pumped his remaining ammunition into a second, which ground observers confirmed crashed. Conger was ready to face the third, which was apparently Futagami himself, when he realized he was out of ammunition. At the last second, he decided to try to slice the Zero's tail off with his propeller, which he later admitted was a crazy thing to do, but give him credit for resourcefulness and determination. His propeller cut the Mitsubishi's fuselage in half, but sent his Grumman into a dive, forcing Conger to bail out. His parachute had barely opened before he splashed. His last target was never seen again. Having downed 3 Zeros, Lieutenant Conger was very nearly killed by a flaming 4th, which plunged into the water only 100 feet away. Its pilot, Petty Officer 2nd Class Ishikawa Shiro, plopped in the water only 20 yards away, shot down by 1st Lieutenant Lawrence Faulkner. A PT boat came out from Lunga to pick up Conger, who suggested they pick up Ishikawa and take him prisoner. Ishikawa had other ideas. He thrust his pistol in Conger's face and pulled the trigger. The waterlogged gun only clicked. Ishikawa then pointed the gun at his own head and pulled the trigger. The pistol clicked again. Conger bashed Ishikawa over the head with a jerry can. A sailor took his gun, and the dazed Japanese pilot was hauled aboard. The tag-team air battles continued. At 11:30, Captain Joe Foss led 4 other Wildcats up. At 12:45, he spotted below him 6 Zeros of the famous Tainan Air Group, led by Warrant Officer Yamashita Shohei, sailing along with splendid calm and indifference over Lunga. Foss dove in to close on 1-0, riddling it with his guns and causing it to explode, but barely missing its flaming engine flying out of the wreckage. Another Zero, apparently that of Yamashita, overshot Foss, and he turned to tail it and give it some liberal treatment. The 4 surviving Zeros broke off around 1:05 p.m. and headed back, but Yamashita's fighter was so shot up he had to ditch on the way back to Rabaul. While Captain Foss was holding off Zeros, 5 Dauntlesses of Scouting 71, under the direction of Lieutenant Commander Eldridge, managed to take off to do something about some of the Japanese ships that were hanging around Lunga. At 1:05 p.m., Eldridge and his crews found the cruiser Yura and the destroyers of the No. 2 attack unit in the northern entrance to Indispensable Strait, some 30 miles northeast of Florida Island. Lieutenant Commander Eldridge himself led off, dropping a 1,000-pound bomb from 3,000 feet that exploded in the Yura's engine room. One of his pilots got a near miss on the cruiser as well. The Yura coasted to a stop, settling by the stern. The large destroyer, Akizuki, took a hit from a small bomb amidships and 2 near misses that ruptured hull plating and flooded her after engine room. The starboard propeller stopped, and her speed was cut to 23 knots. Admiral Takama informed Admiral Mikawa of the attack. Mikawa, in his own words, decided to assemble his forces in the rear area until the recapture of the Guadalcanal airfield was definitely reported. In other words, Takama was to return to Shortland. If he could. The Americans were not through with him. Next came 3 P-39 Aero Cobras of the 67th at 2:35. They scored no hits, nor did 3 SBDs under the command of Lieutenant Ray Davis of Bombing 6. By this time, the Euro's damage control had managed to restore some power, but they could not control the flooding. Skipper Captain Sato Shiro asked Admiral Takama for permission to beach the light cruiser on Fara Island, which Takama granted. But the Americans would make even that short trip difficult. At 4:30 p.m., Lieutenant Commander Eldridge led three Dauntlesses of Scouting 71, four Era Cobras of the 67th Squadron, and three Marine Wildcats in another strike on Admiral Takama's beleaguered group. The Yura took at least one bomb hit that set her afire, and the Akizuki took one near miss. 30 minutes later came six B-17s of the 11th Bombardment Group from Espiritu Santo under